Today's Intellectual State by Ayn Rand.
Ayn Rand delivered this talk on the Columbia University campus radio station in 1968.
The subject of this discussion is today's intellectual state. I quote, "At all levels of American life, people share similar fears, insecurities, and gnawing doubts to such an intense degree that the country may, in fact, be suffering from a kind of national nervous breakdown. The country may now be on the brink of a depression of the national spirit." Close quote. Such is the conclusion reached by an analysis of today's political situation released by the National Committee for an Effective Congress and quoted in the New York Times of December 26, 1967. It is grimly fascinating to hear statements of this kind coming with growing frequency from all sorts of unlikely sources, from groups and people who have not been in the habit of voicing concern about the nation's psychological or intellectual state. Some aspects of the reality, which our public leaders have been philosophically trained to evade, are apparently reaching them now, and they are staring at the spectacle as at a mystery with bewildered, apprehensive uneasiness. On November 24, 1967, the New York Times published a survey entitled "The Season of Discontent, A Political Tour of America." The survey declared that, quote, "The speeches, statistics, and stories do not catch the full flavor of the nation's malaise. They, Americans, resent the war as either pointless or simply too long and costly. They wish to see it end either by honorable disengagement or quick victory. Many feel humiliated by the inconclusive conflict and the dissension on the home front. Hence, the violent protesters are denounced almost as much as the president. People generally feel prosperous, but they give the federal government little credit for it. Many, in fact, look upon Washington as the profligate spender of their wealth, not as its provider or prudent manager." Close quote. Observe, parenthetically, the implicit astonishment at the fact that the people do not look upon Washington as the provider of their wealth. To continue the quotation, quote, "Above all, people yearn for change, but they do not know where to find it. In many voters, the sense of helplessness has produced a pronounced cynicism. There is growing resentment against the anti-poverty program, political welfare gimmicks, and giveaways. Politics as such is not regarded as a noble calling. People condemn President Johnson even as they describe him as a shrewd politician. A number of them say they yearn for a statesman instead. Whereas officials in Washington tend to be preoccupied with the personalities of the president and his potential challengers, most people, when questioned, express their feelings in terms of issues." Close quote. It is the politicians and the modern intellectuals who believe and insist that ideas do not matter, that political campaigns cannot be fought on the issues, that reason is impotent, that the people do not think. But, in fact, the people do think and are starved for intellectual leadership, which does not exist today, neither in politics, nor in the press, nor in any form of public communication. What the people are starved for, what the malaise of the country consists of, is the desperate need for political principles, for a consistent, rational ideology, instead of the insane, pragmatic chaos of pressure group warfare, empty slogans, and blatant hypocrisy in which we are now drowning. It is principles, long-range principles, and a consistent political philosophy that the country needs, and those who are supposed to provide it are further away from understanding that need than the simplest man on the street. As an illustration of the kind of attitude which the best and or worst, as you wish, of our public commentators display, I'd like to quote from a column by James Reston in the New York Times of December 31st, 1967. James Reston, I would like to add, is perhaps the best of today's liberal columnists in the sense that he displays at times some inkling or some mention of the word philosophy and of the country's need for it. But it remains merely an inkling or a brief mention. In a column devoted, or which should have been devoted to this subject, Reston says the following. In short, we do not need a personal government or a party government, but a national government that can restore at least a little more unity and purpose in our national life. And further from the same column, quote, any government is going to have to rely on the confidence of the people, and the chances are that a national government, aided by a cabinet of the best men of all parties, will get more popular support than any personal or partisan government. And further, the candidates and the parties have let the country down, but somebody may get beyond the personal and the party question and see the possibilities of a national government, and whoever does touch this yearning for unity and purpose may very well prevail in November of 1968. Close quote. Mr. Reston does not explain or define what he means by a national government. He defines it merely by opposition, that is, that it would be some form of government which will be the opposite of personal or party government. And he makes a great point out of the fact that such a national government will draw the best brain of the country to formulate its policies, or some kind of brain trust. That is all. In an issue which cries out that it is principles that the country needs in order to achieve unity and purpose, as Mr. Reston claims, that it is a philosophy that one needs in order to unify the nation, that the words national government, as Mr. Reston uses them, clearly imply a government with an objective, consistent, and philosophical policy. Yet, no reference is made to such a dangerous concept as principles. The entire approach seems to be an attempt to talk about the need of a philosophy without ever using the word or using the word principles, without ever stating openly that we need a consistent political ideology and that what we have today is an empty, unphilosophical, unintellectual state of pressure group warfare, that we have no political system to speak of, only the remnants of a former freedom still keeping us together, and that the present ideological and political trend is merely group warfare, pressure group warfare, all scrambling for legislation to gain some advantage of the moment. This, I believe, is what Mr. Aston referred to when he talked about personal government or party government. As opposed to that, he has no better definition to offer than national government, when in fact the missing concept is a government with a consistent political philosophy and a platform of specifically defined principles. Another columnist of the New York Times, who is also quite typical of today's trend, but in a different way, Tom Wicker, wrote on November 23, 1967, "The war in Vietnam continues to have remarkable effects here in the United States. The latest is the Senate Foreign Relations Committee's resolution urging that Congress reassert its power to declare war as a check on the president's virtually unlimited authority over matters of war and peace." Close quote. Commenting somewhat vaguely and approvingly on this declaration or resolution, Mr. Wicker, however, hastens to state the following, quote, "The real need in an age of marvelous technology, instantaneous communications, potential mass destruction, and ever more complex economics is not to destroy the kind of big government that alone can cope with these developments. Rather, the need is for free men to learn how to live with big government. To the extent, however, that it is actually intended to delimit or even precisely define presidential powers over the armed forces, the War Powers Resolution raises more disturbing questions. Laying down broad constitutional doctrines that may hamstring future presidents is not the remedy." Close quote. Mr. Wicker, who is not as subtle nor as philosophical as Mr. Reston, makes it quite clear that the one thing that the active liberal intellectuals of today, or most of them, are concerned about is to pay empty lip service to the constitutional system of checks and balances while being concerned intensely with only one matter, not to dismantle big government. The article is remarkable in the sense in which it presents and condenses an anti-ideology ideology. It admits that we are intellectually and politically in trouble, and in effect, all that it states is please do not have defined laws, a defined constitution. Let us be non-objective and flexible. Please do not dismantle the instruments of power, the power of big government. So much for Mr. Tom Wicker. These two, as I said, are typical of the general tone of expression in or among today's makers of public opinion. They, of course, do not make it, but the extent to which they miss the nature and the trouble of the country is appalling when you consider that they are newspaper men who are supposed to be sensitive to the reality and the trends of the country on which they are reporting. Now observe what this type of intellectual influence is doing to the country. Observe the approach to the coming election in both parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. In both cases and in most of the press comment, The coming election is discussed in terms of concrete. Candidates are asked answers and are asked to take positions on nothing but a long list of concrete problems. The war in Vietnam, inflation, the so-called crime in the streets issue, etc. Nobody is demanding nor answering any of this in terms of principles or causes. Nobody is asked, for instance, what is the principle behind the war in Vietnam? Why should we be in it or why should we get out? Nobody has stated that it is a senseless war in which we had no reason ever to engage. No, all that is asked is only, are you for continuing the war or for ending it? And when inflation is discussed, it is discussed always in terms of government management or in terms of the new economics. What will you do about inflation? Will you take this measure or that measure? This is what is asked of candidates, not any question of principle. If you are against the war in Vietnam, why? If you want to control inflation, how? How in principle? And by what right and by what standard? Questions of that kind are as carefully evaded and avoided in public discussion today as if they had never existed and could not come up. Now, in regard to the particular trends and results of this anti-intellectual, anti-ideological approach, observe the peculiar situations in both parties. An ominous situation exists at present in the Republican Party. The Republican Party is famous for missing its opportunity every time that opportunity arises, an opportunity to save the country or to lead the country to a better road, at least. There were two turning point elections in the past, which were defeated, or rather in which the people was defeated by certain kind of means. And today, that same situation is appearing for the third time, and there is an indication that similar means are intended to be used. Now, to make this clear, in 1940, the country was enormously dissatisfied with Roosevelt's New Deal and very apprehensive about the issue of the third term, about the fact that if Roosevelt ran for a third term, it may confirm him or give him the almost dictatorial power which he was obviously seeking. At that time, the Republican Party had a good chance to express the rising apprehension of the people and to offer an opposition candidate and an opposition program. Unfortunately, the two leading candidates of that time offered by the Republican Party were not very much nor very inspiring, namely Mr. Taft and Mr. Dewey. Neither of them was exactly a representative of any consistent or philosophical viewpoint and could not arouse any serious enthusiasm among Republicans or the country at large, nor give it any kind of decisive leadership. Nevertheless, such as they were, they might have had a chance at least to turn the country away from the road which the New Deal was pursuing. Instead, a so-called liberal Republican, the first of the lot, Wendell Willkie, was pushed on the Republican convention and was nominated predominantly by means of two things. One, a very cleverly managed public relations campaign, but the other and more important, the fact that he seemed to offer an idealistic and ideological leadership, leadership towards the ideals of freedom and capitalism, as against the growing statism of the New Deal trend. This attitude or policy of Willkie's was expressed in numerous articles before he received the presidential nomination. But he was put over on the Republicans. He received that nomination through a pressure group of so-called liberal Republicans. Thereafter, Mr. Willkie ran the most blatant Me Too campaign of the numerous campaigns of that kind run in this country before and since. Willkie's campaign was the most obvious betrayal of any hope that his supporters in the country at large could have had in nominating him, namely the hope of a fighting candidate fighting on principle and with moral righteousness against the New Deal. Instead, Willkie endorsed all the premises of the New Deal and was the most consistent me-tooer of a long and not very honorable line of me-tooers and compromisers before and since. He lost the election, and Roosevelt was elected to a third term, and later even to a fourth. The opportunity for the pro-capitalist, pro-freedom, anti-statist element of the public, of the people at large, in this country was lost. It was sidetracked into the hands of a liberal Republican who, of course, destroyed any possibility of effective opposition. A similar situation arose in 1952. The country was sick and tired of Truman and of the pointless war in Korea. The candidate of the conservative, which is a bad name for the loosely pro-capitalist element in the country, was Senator Taft again. He was not much of a candidate, and he was not much of an idealist. He openly advocated compromise as a moral policy. Nevertheless, symbolically or otherwise, he was the candidate of those who wanted to defeat Truman and his fair deal and put the country back on a road towards capitalism. By a clever public relations campaign and other means, it was Eisenhower who was put over on the Republican convention in 1952 and was nominated president. The convention, I believe, is in 1951, but the election of 1952. Eisenhower won that election for the liberal Republicans. The setback to any kind of consistent, specific, or brave opposition to the welfare state trend of the country was all but killed under the Eisenhower administration. The election of 1952 accelerated the trend toward statism more than any election of the Democrat could have done, because it had now destroyed any effective opposition or even semi-effective, clear-cut opposition on the part of the Republicans. they could not be pro-capitalism any longer, implicitly, even though they never dared state it explicitly or draw the issues clearly. The Republicans under Eisenhower were now officially the milder or more timid branch of the same welfare state movement as the Democrats. Any serious opposition to the welfare state all but vanished in the years since. The disintegration of public opinion, of the press, of the intellectual leadership of this country in the Eisenhower years was worse, more disastrous, and more sweeping than anything that had occurred under his predecessors in office. Today, in 1968, we have a third opportunity of this kind. The indignation of the country against Johnson's Great Society, there isn't much difference between them. The indignation against that Great Society is enormous. Johnson, who got into office in 1964 by a tremendous popular landslide, in four brief years has become the most universally unpopular figure of any presidential incumbent in this century, and perhaps of any ever. His own party is against him, and every type of different opinion or pressure group is against him. This is the time for a Republican to bring a new unity, if you wish, or a new leadership to the country by offering a platform and a philosophy of pro-capitalism and away from the bankrupt welfare state of today, bankrupt financially and ideologically. The leading candidate of the Republicans today is, in a somewhat feeble way, the best of the lot, and that is Richard Nixon. He did not do such a good job in 1960. He was quite a meteor. He seems, however, to have improved, to have grown somewhat. I hope that no one will take this statement as an endorsement of Mr. Nixon. All I can say is that at present, up to the minute, and I have no way of knowing what he will do or say tomorrow, but up to the minute, he seems to be doing better than he did previously. He seems to have grown more mature and more consistently pro-capitalism. And observe the attempt to kidnap or switch this opportunity. There is talk now about a Rockefeller-Reagan ticket, about a compromise between the conservative element in the party and an arch exponent of the worst of the liberal Republicans, namely Governor Rockefeller. This is merely talk so far, but I would like to point out to any pro-capitalist, particularly to young pro-capitalists, do not fall for it. Make it clear now by any means you have that you would not vote for nor support a disgraceful compromise of that kind, that Mr. Reagan's popularity will not carry him and the country with him to a betrayal of all of the ideals that permitted him to rise, a betrayal as shameful as any alliance with the Republican liberals.
For additional information about other available programs, please contact Second Renaissance at 1-800-729-6149 or at www.ayn randbookstore.com. All material in this program is protected by copyright and may not be reproduced in any form or manner, nor played before an audience, without the express written permission of the producer, Second Renaissance Incorporated.